Good morning, members and everybody present. Unfortunately, the chairperson of Mahdi is unable to attend today's sitting. In his absence, we need to elect a standing chairperson. So can I call for any nominations?
The whip, please. I'm proposing the whip to chair the meeting. The name of the whip is Honorable Van Rowan.
I shall second it.
Thank you very much, members, for once more giving me this assignment. And let me take this opportunity to welcome you from your much-deserved break. As indicated earlier, our chairperson is not with us due to other assignments of national interest. And I hope where he is, he's also well, and he observed his break appropriately. Now, the unfortunate thing is that we are starting our meeting, our first meeting after our break, late. So I wonder, is this a forerunner of bad things to come? Or I'm not sure. A special word of welcome to Honorable Mfundisi, who is a member from the UCDT, who had an opportunity today to join us. Thank you very much, sir, for gracing our committee meeting. And also a special word of welcome to the National Treasury Delegation. And I'm definitely sure that most of us are familiar with most of the delegation here, because our committee hasn't changed. Maybe the only person who might be having a problem of knowing all of you is Honorable Fundisi. But thank you very much, members, I mean, for coming and continuing with your assignments on behalf of our nation. And a special word of welcome to our support staff and our friends from the media and our publication, parliamentary publication institution. Members, without any waste of time, allow me to indicate to yourselves that today we are meeting here to deal with the draft taxation laws amendment bill. And as a known fact, I mean, we are amending tax laws, I mean, from time to time, in the main to ensure that we provide for our fiscal projections or determination as outlined in our fiscal framework, but also responding to the dynamic environment in which our financial systems find themselves in. And in the main, we are effecting some technical corrections where it's deemed fit, just to make sure that we remain our tax laws remain relevant and also remain valid, because it's very critical for ourselves to interrogate the relevancy and the applicability of our tax law on a continuous basis. Now, what is going to happen today is just an introduction. This is the initial briefing to the committee on the envisaged tax laws amendments. And, of course, from here, there will be, as usual, there will be hearings allowed to accommodate the public and stakeholder submission. I can see some of our stakeholders are already part of this engagement. A special word of welcome to yourselves also, Professor, and other stakeholders that are here. And then after the hearings, we are going to then receive feedback. The hearings are scheduled to take place on the 22nd of next month. Is it the, sorry? What's happening? I told you this late starting is a forerunner of bad things to come. So all of a sudden people think we are in August already. No, we are still in July, the 31st of July today, so I'm speaking of tomorrow, which is a new month. And we are envisaging, of course, we have a feedback from National Treasury on submissions on the 4th of September. And obviously, after that, we will the bill will then be formally introduced to Parliament. And thereafter, we will then have to interrogate the bill for the purpose of adoption. You know, we are envisaging that goes according to plan, on the 18th of September, we must then be adopting this as a committee. These are just time scales. It's not like a fixed date. If the committee feels that we need more time to interrogate, that will be considered. But in terms of our planning, we are in decision to do that on the 18th of September. Now, I'm going to allow the DBG, Momo, to take us through the presentation, or maybe to make an indication who will be taking us through the presentation. Mama, over to you. Thank you.
As you know, we've got Keith Engel and Cecil Morton and myself from the Treasury and Franz Tomasek from SARS. Chair, I'm going to get right into the heart of the matter, because this is, just to remind ourselves very quickly, this is still part of the overall tax process, which started with a budget where, in a budget speech and a budget review, there's a chapter and annexes devoted to the tax proposals for the year. This year we decided that we should have a separate bill just to deal with all the rates and thresholds issues. We had to do that because we were, especially with all the capital gains changes, we needed to make some of those amendments sooner rather than later. Even though we have the problem that that bill is, although it's been processed by the NA by June, it was released in March, just after the budget, but it's still sitting in the NCOP, and that process is still due to be finalized. This bill then deals, the Taxation Laws Amendment Bill is the normal bill that we bring. It deals with anything and everything in the tax proposals, except for, and so it's easier to say what it doesn't do then. So it doesn't deal with all the rates and threshold issues. Those now have been dealt with. And it also doesn't deal with areas where there's going to be specific legislation, like the gambling taxes, that will be done through a separate bill, a dedicated bill, and also some of the retirement discussion documents that we've released. The announcements were made even last year and this year. That's got a longer consultation track that we're going through. So this bill doesn't deal with those types of issues. Just to move on, and I'll move on to okay. Just to remind ourselves, these were the proposals, what they attempted to do. You've seen this slide before, so it's not a new slide. And just to get back and to remind ourselves that we are forced in terms of the Constitution to split the bills into a section 75 and 77 bill. The main bill is 77. It's a money bill. 75 deals with all the admin issues because the Constitution says any substantive issues other than the actual tax issues have to go through in a separate track. And as you are aware, money bill may only be amended in terms of the Money Bill's Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act. And that, for that reason, what we tend to do with the tax proposal is to come up with a draft bill before we formally table it, which is what we intend to do. So we release the bill out for public comment in July. We try and do it earlier, but we don't always succeed. This year it is a bit late, and unfortunately when it's a bit late, then it does impact on consultation times because we have to fit in with the parliamentary schedule, obviously, as well. But after it's released, we continue to have meetings with all kinds of groups that are ready to respond, whether it's on REITs, with banks and insurers. There's been meetings taking place. We've also having workshops on individual and savings taxpayer workshop tomorrow. What's it? DBSA or somewhere, right? And of course today we're making the presentation. So we continue with all our own workshops, even as the committee processes it and as we are receiving public comments. And as you've outlined, Chair, next month there'll be the hearings when people can come and still present on the bill. We hope they don't wait till then to submit all their comments, that they do it sooner rather than later. And then, of course, you've outlined the 4th and the 11th as dates for the formal tabling. I think just to move on then, this bill deals with a number of issues, and perhaps I'll just ask Keith to deal with it. To actually deal with what the Tax Laws Amendment Bill therefore deals with, I should remind members that we do publish quite a detailed explanatory memo that goes with the bill. And that's meant to be an easier version for members and the members of the public to understand. And I use the word understand quite deliberately, because as you know, because tax amendments tend to be amendments to current acts like the Income Tax Act, the VAT Act, nobody can make sense of it just reading it, because it says add this, remove that, etc. So to try and read that is really almost an exercise in futility unless you are a legal person and you want to get through the nitty-gritty of the wording. So I'm not stopping you from doing it, especially if you're bored at night and you need to sleep, maybe, you know. But more importantly, what the explanatory memo does is it then tries to explain what a particular clause is trying to do, what the problem is, what the solution is, so to give you that kind of context behind the amendment. These slides will, of course, focus and zoom in on the main issues, but I would recommend that the explanatory memo is what you refer to get the broad thrust of it. Obviously, we still need to get the wording right. That is important. But that, I think, you will pick up through the hearings and comments that are made. So, Keith, perhaps you can just kick off with the individual business and international changes in this bill.
Yes. I mean, what you have basically is we always break things out, and even the explanatory memorandum does this. You'll see that we put the individual in savings first, we then put the business, and then the international and the VAT. This year you don't see much on VAT because they're mostly technical corrections and miscellaneous amendments. But basically the main themes are individual business and the international. And I'm just going to take you through. I know we have a limited amount of time, so I don't want to overburden you. I'm just going to hit the highlights here. But the main focus now this year on individual and savings is fairly light. There isn't many changes for individuals' employment change in savings this year. They're mostly making life a little easier for everyone, and that's what's happening here overall. Now, we've had the medical credit story. I'm not going to go into this again. I think we discussed this on the rates and thresholds bill. If Seth wants to jump in, that's fine. But essentially, the essence of what we were doing was we were converting deductions to credits. And the reason why we were trying to do that, we were trying to shift the credit more in favor of lower and middle income as opposed to upper income. We've discussed that several times. This is just another table, and that's all I'm going to say about that. Then, in terms of some other changes, all these are within the budget, is that there's a few changes on retirement. The bigger changes are coming on the discussion paper, but one of the smaller areas that we're making a change on is how we deal with annuities. Now, when you retire, you can either take a lump sum or you can take an annuity. Now, as a matter of government policy, we actually, I think, prefer you to take the annuity, not the lump sum. But the way the world works now is there are a number of advantages for tax advantages for taking a lump sum, and those need to be unwound. Now, what we've done here is we've unwound the first one. Sometimes you make a contribution, and most contributions to retirement should be deductible. But if you exceed the limits or for various reasons, you make a non-deductible contribution going in. When you get the money out, you get a tax-free amount coming out. But right now, the tax-free amount coming out only applies to the lump sum. If you take it out as annuity, you don't get the tax-free amount, the pre-tax amount. So what essentially the bill does is if you make a non-deductible contribution, if you pull it out as an annuity...
Sorry, sure. Can I ask you just to quickly repeat exactly what you said with the lump sum and then...
Sure.
Slower.
Okay, go slower. Okay, I'll try to go slower. Right? Okay. Yes. Okay. The way your retirement works is every year you make a contribution. And when you make that contribution, it's typically deductible. Once it grows tax-free. It just keeps growing. It's a pension. That way we encourage you to save. The only time we tax you is when the money is withdrawn. Now, there are two ways to take the money out of pension. One, you can take it out as a lump sum, or you can take it out as an annuity, which means you get a little bit every year. Now, it depends. In most pensions, you're allowed to take out one-third as a lump sum, two-thirds as an annual annuity. So you usually split it. Case of Provident Funds, you have a complete choice. So you basically have two choices when you get the money out. If you pull money out as a lump sum, you have a formula approach. If you take the money out as annuity, it's just added to your normal income. That's essentially how the world works. Now, the two should work roughly the same, but they don't. One example is if you make a non-deductible contribution. You can make a non-deductible contribution with after-tax income to retirement planning. If you put that in, it's not deductible. It still grows tax-free. But when it comes out as a lump sum, because you didn't get a deduction up front, right now under the current law, you will get the money back tax-free as a lump sum. However, under current law, if you pull it out as an annual annuity, you get fully taxed. So to the extent that you're making a contribution that's non-deductible, you always have to take it out as a lump sum, otherwise you're going to be taxed on it. And so what this amendment does, it basically shifts it so it says, if you take out a non-deductible contribution either in a lump sum or an annuity, it's tax-free. And that way we even it up. Because we don't want to encourage you to take the money out the day you retire. We want you to take it over the period of your retirement. So that's only one fault line here. There are some other problems between the two as well, between lump sum and annuities. And still, the lump sum has certain advantages, and I think we need to look at that and make sure that it's completely even across the board. And that's something that's being discussed. But this is a step in that direction. That's what this amendment is. Is that fair enough? Next one is divorce. This is one of my favorite subjects because if you've been through a divorce, this always brings back great emotions. But we're actually trying to help people here. What happens on divorce is you divide your assets. You don't divide them happily, but you divide them nonetheless. And one of the big assets on retirement is your retirement pension. Who's going to get the pension? Is it going to be you or your spouse? Are you going to split it? And this issue has been going on for years. But the main issue has been under old law, if you separated from your spouse, you were still tied together until retirement. So the way it would work in a typical scenario is the husband would give the wife half the money in the retirement fund, but it had to stay in the retirement fund. And then when she withdrew it, she withdrew it at retirement, but he had to pay the tax. So that meant for a lot of unhappy ex-husbands. Although I know a story recently where the wife was in the reverse position. But similarly, there was another problem at the time that the wife didn't get the growth on retirement, he did. So the whole system was completely distorted. And so several years ago in 2009, we changed the divorce rules and we changed the pension rules to allow for a clean break principle. That when the husband and wife split the pension in half, they split it in half, there would be no tax event, they would both live separate lives, separate pension lives, and they would both be able to grow separately and they would be taxed separately. The problem is while we did it in most cases, we didn't do it in all cases. And one area where you don't have that is the government employee pension fund and a number of government-related pension funds where the clean break principle did not exist because they're under different regulation. What we've done here is we've split them across the board. The other one that also comes in is there's a Formula C, which if you were in government before 1998, you were able to get a tax-free pension. And you're also splitting that so it's evenly divided. And so essentially that was something that was pushed heavily by the GPF and others. We announced this actually a number of months back. I think everybody's very happy with this. But when you want a divorce, clean break. And we're just completing the clean break principle. Those are basically what those slides are. The big thing on the slides where it's complicated is there's a myriad of effective dates. And all I can say is there's reasons that you're stuck with the past and you're trying to transition to the future. But it's getting into that alignment of effective dates. Then there's another area where we're fixing, and that is employer-employee relationships. And what happens for employers is whenever they pay employees, they have to withhold. It's a very core part of every tax system, is a withholding system. The difficulty is that generally when you're doing withholding, it's fairly simple. You pay every week, you get a check every week, you see the government takes money out every week, and that's the way it works. But there are a number of payments where it's uncertain what's going on with bonuses and commissions and vacation pay. And under the current tax rules, you have to take these into account as they accrue and not as they are received. Now, you will get money. Money will accrue to you before it's received by you. So, for instance, you might have a bonus check, and they might have made the calculation, and you're owed the bonus check, but they haven't done all the sign-offs to give you the money. Under current law, what happens is the employer gets an immediate deduction, but the employee has immediate income, even though the employee hasn't received any money yet. Now, that also creates a problem for the employer because he's got to withhold even though they don't have the money. And there's a whole series of small things with annually bonuses, commissions, and other variable payments that are creating a constant problem of calculation, which gives rise to unintended audits and other problems for SARS. And so there basically was an agreement between SARS and the taxpayers where they would simplify PAYE, and that when you have these variable payments, that you will just look them on a cash basis. So when you get the money is when you're taxed, when there is withholding. The only price of the system is the employer will only get a deduction only when that goes out as well. So it's a matching system. And that's how we generally like our employment system to work. I think most people are in favor of this, but of course they will see what happens. But I think this is generally a helpful amendment. Then there's our favorite friend, the employer-provided vehicles, the company cars. This is a very small amendment just to change the calculation. Sometimes employers will rent a car and then give the employees the use of that rental. And we have a very complicated formula for employer provision. And basically what we've done is we've taken them out of the formula, and whatever the employer is paying for the rental car is the employee inclusion as a fringe benefit to the extent the employee is using that for private use. So that was sort of streamlined. But there continues to be issues in this area on employer-provided cars. And I think what we're trying to do here basically is this. If you have business use, we want to let you, if it's general business use, you don't want to tax people on that. On the other hand, there's an entrenched set of people who are actually using company cars as a fringe benefit. And really, they should be getting an additional salary. They shouldn't be using company cars. And that balance is a constant problem. Because if we simplify too much, we leave loopholes. And then people start buying company cars as a fringe benefit package. And we don't want to go in there. I haven't said anything out of line. But this is a fairly simple amendment, and that cleans that up. And that's all there is on individual and savings. Individual and savings is fairly straightforward. It's mostly minor amendments this year. I think the bigger issues to come are more on retirement, which is in the discussion document. Now, in the business and the international, I'm only going to cover the highlights. There's a number of amendments here, but we do have limited time. The first ones I'm going to cover is business, and what I mean is generally domestic business. So, the first issue, and that is the major issue of this package, is issues relating to debt and shares. And that was sort of an outgrowth of the 45 discussion that we had last year, the famous 45. But the real issue in 45, as discussed last year, wasn't 45, it was really the use of debt. And when you look at debt and equity, they have different tax consequences. Now, the game of the what is the impact here? Now, on the one side, for the tax system, it's very important that debt is debt and it's not being recharacterized. Because one of the most powerful things about debt is when you pay interest, you get a deduction. The payee, i.e. the bank, will have an inclusion. But where the tax system is at risk is the party paying the interest gets a deduction, but the other side is exempt. They could be an exempt pension fund or a foreign resident or others. But those are the main categories. And if we're not careful, people will convert and call things debt when it's really shares to generate deductions. And that becomes a major cost to the fiscus. Most importantly, if you allow people to recharacterize shares as debt, you can basically call an end to the company tax. And indeed, there's an IFA conference in October discussing this issue. This is an international problem that the corporate tax base is being eroded with excessive claims of debt. On the other hand, the issue of debt and equity is very important for business. First and foremost is the issue of finance. Finance is critical for businesses to grow. And businesses need that finance. And finance in these days, since 2007 and 8, has become a scarcity. So you don't want to dry up finance unnecessarily. There's also sometimes people are using debt to overcome other problems. And you'll see that with the REITs in particular, which I will come to. Now, so there are times where basically business is trying to use debt to overcome other difficulties. So the stakes here are very high, which means that we have to tread very carefully. And that's what we're trying to do. But that's, I think, the message of today. Now, when you look at debt versus equity, in the traditional sense, there are different commercial features. But when you borrow money, you have to repay it. The bank is not going to give you money, and you're not going to have to repay. Similarly, the bank wants the money whether you're profitable or not. The fact that your business has failed, you still owe the interest. Banks are very insistent on that. So interest is something that's based on the time value of money, and it's something that you must collect. Also, banks tend to have high priority on cash flows. They want their money first before you're paying the shareholders. And those are the main differences in management. On the other hand, shares, in the purest sense, ordinary shares, are non-redeemable. They can remain out there forever. You own a company forever. You own shares forever. And when you pay out profits, you're paying them out as dividends, and it's coming out of profits. If you're in a loss-making position, you can't pay profits. Those are the fundamental features of debt and equity. The difficulty is in a modern world, those things have gotten blurred. And sometimes they've gotten blurred for good commercial reasons, and sometimes they've gotten blurred for tax reasons. And the difficulty for us is we need to separate the two. Because if we stand behind blindly, the corporate tax is gone. Now remember, we have three tax bases, individuals, corporate, and the VAT. We have others, but those are our primary. And if we lose on the corporate tax base, we're going to have to make up money elsewhere. So it's important for us. On the other hand, businesses need finance, and we don't want to inhibit finance because that's going to slow commercial activity. So those are the essential features. Now, I'm not going to go through this too much here, but there's a number of choices to how to contain this. The difficulty is no one option works perfectly. There is no silver bullet here. And in many systems, this becomes a bit of a cancer to the system. But so on the one hand, you've got to be careful. So what we have done is we are focusing on features. And the other one that's been raised in discussion documents is overall ceilings, that you can't have excessive levels of debt. The problem is each of those options only works so well. And so what we're trying to do is find the right combination. It's like the right combination of cancer drugs. You don't want to kill the patient, but you've got to cure the disease. So it is going to be a very fine tuning, and that's going to require a lot of consultation. Now, what the bill does is it breaks up debt and shares in a paradigm. And what you see, the most important is on the left. What you see on the one side in the very top is something called debt, which is pure debt, and at the bottom, which is equity shares, which is pure shares. And then what you have are grades in between. And the bottom line is as those grades change, the tax consequences should change. It's just getting the right mix. So what you see is on the top debt, that's pure debt. Sometimes you'll have debt with a hybrid yield. You'll have debt that is non-redeemable, so you don't ever have to pay it back, the principal. Or you might have hybrid debt, I'm not sure, I've got some little errors in the slides, where the debt might be dependent on profits. Or you might have shares that pay an interest-like dividend. Or they might be guaranteed in such a way they're secured like debt. So there are a range of these features, and we've already begun the work last year on a number of these things. But the things that we've mostly worked on is where shares have debt-like features. We have not focused on debt with share-like features, essentially what's going on. Now, the biggest amendments from an anti-avoidance bill, proposal in this bill, is these next few amendments. Now, the bill has got a lot of things that are assisting taxpayers, and there are things that we have to protect the tax base. So the bill contains a mix of both. But the issue that's here is hybrid debt. Now, what we tried to do is identify features where we felt there was common levels of avoidance. This has come out of the 45 process last year when we met with all the taxpayers, and what we began to identify are the features of the continuing area of avoidance. One of them is debt that you never have to repay. So the bill says if you don't have to repay the debt in 30 years, that starts to look like a problem for us. The second area, and that seems to be a little more controversial, is that if you don't have to pay the debt in cash, but you can pay it off in shares, and which means that if the company is not profitable, you don't really have to pay it off. And those are the two focuses on something called 8F and 8, on 8F. That's the top part. The second is the yield based on profit? Do you have to pay the bank regardless? Or if you're not profitable, you don't have to pay the bank? And what we tried to do is identify those features here. But what we did is we put a 2014 effective date. And we delayed the effective date here because we know this is a fairly big issue. And we want to make sure we're not picking up anomalies. I think the issue before us is discussion time. We do believe this is important, but we want to make sure that this is done in a commercial manner and that we pick up the real facts and be able to separate the good from the bad. And that's what we've been trying to consult with taxpayers. And that's what we're actually doing for the next couple of days, and we continue to do that as much as possible. A related amendment is on 23L. And this amendment is worried about a different form of avoidance, where you are a borrower and you're paying an exempt person. And in a lot of the concerns that we saw last year in the 45 was that we had these bullet loans. And what would happen is a foreign company or a foreign group would take over a South African group. They would enter into a series of foreign loans. And what would happen is they would have a huge amount of interest on the loans, which would eliminate all company profits. But they didn't have to pay the interest until after 5 years, in which case at that point they rebooted the transaction and never ultimately paid the interest. So they almost got deductions whenever they never had to pay. And what this proposal does is it defers the deduction until payment. But this one is also turning out to be a bit controversial and really should be looked at like the last one. And we should have probably put down a 2014 effective date on this one as well. And that's something you should have done, and that I take responsibility for. But these two, I think we're being very careful here. We need a lot of discussion on. But these are important. They are important to protect the corporate tax base. So we will be engaging with the taxpayers, and we will be reverting back to you. I'm going to go a little quicker. Some of these things came from last year. There are a number of proposals where banks were using preference share funding. Now, banks normally loan. That's what they do. They don't really give preference share funding. All of the preference shares they give really are like loans, and they do everything they can to make them look like loans. So they have all these guarantees. The yield is based on interest. But the difficulty we had in this, and this we've already went through last year, was that a lot of times our tax system doesn't give you, when you borrow money to buy shares, you don't get a deduction, or you can't use the deduction. And so if the borrower can't use the deduction, it creates a big problem if they borrow money. And what the banks were doing is using preference share funding, because effectively the borrower isn't going to get a deduction, but the preference share dividends are exempt. And what happens is, basically, the banks are getting use of the failure to get the deduction. We went through this last year. The amendments that we made this year are mostly refining that legislation. So I'm not going to go through that again, but we've met extensively with the banks. And what we've tried to do is get the right balance so that we're protecting share company acquisitions, including BEE share funding, while we've tried to contain the abuse. So we basically try to have a fine cut. That's essentially what we're trying to do on the debt side as well. So I'm going to pass through these slides because these were mostly discussed last year, and we're refining what we did. Then on the other side is the beginning of company reorganization review. And 10 years ago, when we enacted capital gains, I think it's 11 years now, we said, well, once we've enacted a capital gain regime, most capital gain regimes provide rollover relief for company merger and acquisitions. And that basically makes sure that capital gains doesn't tax you when you don't get the cash. So they're the famous provisions of 41 through 47 that allow companies rollover relief on reorganization. Now, what's happened is the company law has changed fundamentally, and that is calling into review the tax rules. We've announced that in the budget, but this year we just began on a straightforward thing. And one of the amendments this year is simply on share recapitalizations, where a company simply swaps the shares. So you might own ordinary share class A, you surrender it for maybe two shares in the same class, or a different ordinary class A. And so what we basically do is extend rollover relief for that. And that's all we're doing here, and I think that's a fairly non-controversial amendment. I think taxpayers will like that. Then the other thing that we've picked up is that in the company reorg area especially, there is a small group of people who are misusing the reorganization rules. So while 80% of the people are acting in good faith, there's always that small crowd that likes to use the tax system for something else. And what they use the reorganization rules to have mismatches, where they don't do value-for-value exchanges. And they just use the reorganization rules to shift value from one entity to another. And what the reorganization, these rules do is they say, if you're shifting value, we are going to tax you on that value shift. That's essentially what these rules do. And then there's some examples here. And we'll be discussing that. I think the legislation needs to be refined a little bit, but I think that's fairly strong. Then there's something that's quite revolutionary in the tax system for the first time, and that out of last year's discussions, what we found was a lot of people were using Section 45 because when they borrowed money to buy shares, they couldn't get the interest deduction. And that's what you heard in Parliament over and over and over again. We don't get the interest deduction when we borrow money to buy shares. And so we allowed them to do it indirectly through Section 45. What we've done here is you said what you can do indirectly, you can do it directly now. So now if you borrow money to take over a company, which is when 45 would arise, we will give you the interest deduction because we're giving it to you indirectly. So we're basically allowing you to go through the front door and you don't have to go through the side door anymore. And that's part of, again, the trade-off. If we trade the anti-avoidance rules off, we then can be more generous on the front end on the commercial side. So you'll always see a mix and match of tax proposals, trying to get people to do things commercially rather than through an avoidance form of way of doing things. Then here's another amendment that's also been long in coming, and that is debt reduction. The tax system in 2001 and historically, and we looked around this internationally, many tax systems punish you for going bankrupt. And if you're in trouble with the bank, many tax systems say that if the bank relieves you of some of the debt that you owe, you've been enriched. And because you've been enriched, we need to tax you. So the example is you have a business, it's in trouble, you owe 5 million rand, you renegotiate with your bank, you bring your bank loan down to 3 million, the tax man says, hey, you've been enriched by 2 million rand. Therefore, we're going to tax you. And that, while that makes sense from a tax point of view because you've been enriched, it is not effective commercially. And what you've done is you're actually punishing people for taking risk. And one of the differences in some systems is they say, look, we know that you've taken a risk. We want to make sure that we can get yourself back on your feet again. So if you look at the company law, they have business rescue provisions. They're revising the insolvency rules because we're saying that we want to allow you to fail. We don't want to kick you up. We don't want to kick you when you get back up. So essentially what the tax system is doing here is that we are providing a more generous set of rules when you get debt cancellation. And what's happening is instead of getting any immediate tax, what we're doing is reducing the tax attributes. So if you bought a building for 5 million rand and you borrowed 5 million and the bank cancels 2, we will reduce your base cost by 2 million. So your base cost will only be 3 million. But you won't have any immediate tax anymore. And so the rules are designed to soften that blow. And it's surprising, actually, we did an international comparison. There are not too many countries that provide relief on debt cancellation. I'm not quite sure why. But the results of the comparison was a lot poorer than I expected. So I think we are moving in a direction that's a little more generous internationally, but I think it's a good one. And that's essentially what we have. I'm not going to go through the details of that. But there's the complexities in this area is quite large because we have capital assets and ordinary assets and the combination and all of that. But that's essentially what we've done. Then another area in the business is a long-held issue, and that is government transfers and subsidies. Now, if government gives you money, most people think that's tax-free. Okay, and we're not talking about services and working for government. We're not talking about government tenders. We're talking about government programs. Taxi recap. The DTI have a whole host of programs. And what they're trying to do is get businesses started. Now, there's a long history to this, but without going into the history too much, what most people want is they want those grants to be tax-free. And so what we've done is we've made the grants tax-free. There's really a choice here, though. Government can give you a grant that's tax-free, or they can give you a taxable grant, and they just give you more money to cover the tax. Having gone through the process endlessly, it's easier to give a grant that's tax-free. That's having all the discussions. But what we've done is we've had an issue. So what we've done in this rule is we made it tax-free, but we've made sure that you don't get any double-dipping benefits. So, for example, if they give you $100,000 to acquire employees, so you get $100,000 for government, and then you pay $100,000 of salary, we don't let you get a deduction for the amount you pay to the employees because you got the money tax-free. So we don't want you double-dipping the system. And that's basically what the rules do. The other thing the rules do is they create a list of what is a government grant for tax purposes. The reason why that list approach is very important is it's often very hard to determine when something is a grant or when it's a service. And then it becomes a big battle for the revenue service to try to figure that out. And so the Treasury has made it easier for everybody. It says, this is the list. The list is quite extensive if you look at the bill. I think there are about 30 items. And it's very clear these are exempt. If you're outside of that, then you're a taxable grant. And that ends the disputes and makes it easier for everyone. So this was done in consultation with a number of departments. So I think this is being greeted fairly favorably. These are the anti-double dipping rules. Okay? I'm just going to mention this one once, but I'm not sure if this is going to gloss over. We did something last year to deal with session schemes. Now, session schemes are ones that most normal people, when they buy shares, they buy the share and they get the dividends with it. You just buy a share. But in the corporate world, one of the favorite schemes is to separate the dividend stream from the shares. And the reason why they do that is dividends are tax-free to companies. There's a whole bunch of schemes out there where people are ceding tax-free dividends in order to move the exemption all over the place. And last year we went to close it down. Now this year they're coming back at us and they're saying that the words are too broad. So we changed the rules again to narrow out what we wanted. And what we wanted was the guy who gets the dividends should be the guy who holds the shares. You cannot separate the fruit from the tree being the share, the fruit being the dividend. But again, they're arguing that they don't like the word hold. Now, the problem I'm having with the word hold, what? Yes, the fruit and tree. Yes. You have to, we love fruits and trees, otherwise you're not a true tax lawyer, right? We love them. So I actually don't, you know, that's, but anyway, we love the fruits and the trees. So don't separate the fruit from the tree. That's all. And we're saying that you must hold the tree in order to get the exemption. But there's now a big dispute as to what hold means, okay? And I can't seem to get any agreement as to what hold means. So we're looking at this legislation to get the words right. But what we mean is if you have beneficial rights, if you bear the risk and reward of the tree, you will get tax-free dividends. That's essentially what we're dealing with. But this will be discussion amongst the tax lawyers, and we will argue endlessly about fruits and trees and the various things. But I'm sure that'll be a discussion next time. But it's just a technical correction from last year's legislation. Okay, that's what you talk about, the general business rules. Now, these are going to, I'm trying to go a little quicker. Fair value taxation. Typically, you are only taxed when you sell something, not before. And that was in line with accounting many years ago, that you only accounted for it on your books when you sold it for realization purposes as a general matter. But as time has gone on, we've had more and more sophisticated instruments called derivatives and all sorts of complex financial products and engineering. And accounting has dealt with this by something called the mark-to-market system. And basically, even if you don't sell these things, you account for them on your books annually, and you keep a track of the value on a regular basis. And the reason why these are highly liquid. What the banks have asked us, and this is actually a request on their part, that they be taxed on a mark-to-market basis, even before they sell, for systems purposes, even though their tax rate will increase, because they can't keep track of two systems, one for tax and one for accounting. And the revenue service also has difficulty, because the accounting is so out of line with tax right now, it's much harder to audit. So what we're basically doing is bringing accounting directly into the tax system. And we're doing this for the banks and the brokers, and that's been negotiated. I think most people are happy. There are a few areas of debate, but I think the general principle is well accepted. This is something, by the way, that's been long in coming, about 10 years we've been talking about this. I'll move on to the next one. The other area that's also come into play is the insurers want to be on a mark-to-market basis of taxation. And so they're also moving on an annual basis of taxation. And the reason why is long-term insurers, when they hold your investments, they take into account your tax notionally on an annual basis. We've negotiated this with the key players in the industry. There may be a little bit of dispute. Some people like this. Most people like it, but there are one or two players are objecting, and we're going to have to work that out. But this was generally done with the media statement and a lot of consultation with the long-term insurers. And most the service and the long-term insurers are generally in favor of this approach. Then there's something else which you'll never, ever want to look at. And you'll never understand, no matter how many times I explain it. I can give you three trees.
Can you just repeat the approach they agreed upon with other policy insurance companies?
With the long-term policyholders, it's an annual approach that we tax the funds on an annual basis on the growth or shrinkage of the fund. So if you have an individual policyholder fund or a company policyholder fund, and it's held by a long-term insurer, the gain or loss will be taxed on an annual basis because the long-term insurers are keeping track of the tax on an annual basis. What that means is the growth of the funds in the tax is taxed as it grows. You don't have to sell. If it shrinks, you get the loss immediately as well. But you just follow the value, which they report to the policyholders. Along with this proposal is something called the Four Funds Formula. And you'll see this is sort of a simplified version of the Four Funds Formula on the top. I plus R plus F plus 2.5 R. If your eye is glossing over, that's the way it is with this formula. This formula is how we allocate how much deductions the insurer gets for policyholder funds. This is an extremely complicated formula. And it's trying to take into account a whole bunch of things. And once we changed the mark-to-market system of taxation, it was agreed that we would simplify this formula. So it was a trade-off. And basically, once we were able to do mark-to-market taxation, all we said is if the policyholder wants to get deductions, you just have to look at taxable income over gross economic income. That's essentially what it is, and it's a formula based on that. And the insurers want this formula very much, at least most of them do. So it's sort of a trade-off between things. But it will simplify a whole series of disputes and distortions in the system that are going on. And that's why we're pushing for it. But, again, I think we'll come back on that. Then there is something called real estate investment trust. And one of the things that makes tax so complicated is we're dealing with every element of finance. So you have to understand all the financial vehicles that are out there. So you as an investor, you can invest in a collective investment scheme, those unit trusts. You can invest in something called a PUT, a PLS. You can invest in a long-term insurer. You can invest in a bank. You can invest in a pension fund. And we have to account for all of these. And what a real estate investment trust is a property fund. Instead of owning a building and owning a rental flat, you can buy an interest in an entity, and they will give you a rental stream. So, for instance, if you look at all your shopping malls you go to, the bulk of the shopping malls are owned by something called a property loan stock company. And what the property loan stock company does is it generates commercial rent, and it pays it to the unit holders. So instead of buying the shopping mall yourself, which you can't afford, we all get together and we buy the shopping mall. And in the current law that we have under the FSB, we have something called property unit trusts. Those are the ones that historically invested in those. But the property unit trust regulation is viewed as overly restrictive. And the reason why it's overly restrictive, according to the industry, is it requires the fund to separate the assets from the managers. The managers have to be in a separate entity from the actual fund itself. And in property, you need to oversee your investments directly. So a whole industry has emerged called property loan stock companies. And all of these things are on the JSE. And right now, there are about 6 puts out there, but there are about 22 to 25 property loan stock companies. But only the puts are regulated. The PLSs are not. But the benefit of being regulated for a put is they get special flow-through treatment, that there's no tax at the put level, only at the unit level. And what we've done is through the JSE regulations, is we're bringing the property loan stocks into regulation. But at the same time, they're getting the benefit of flow-through treatment. But really, the best answer is them to be regulated, I think, by the FSB. But that, I think, we have to discuss later. But on the JSE, we've moved them in that sphere. The regulation is improved, and then we can put the new tax consequences around it. And basically what it gives is flow-through treatment. This has been heavily discussed with the industry. I think most people view this as a win-win. It's a win for the revenue service, and it's also a win for the taxpayers. There are still some refinements, which we're working out now. The big issue that's still on the table is unlisted property loan stock companies. And those will have to be discussed over the course of the next year. Quickly, just short-term insurance reserves. We're basically, short-term insurance has a very complicated system of reserving. What we've done with the industry is we basically aligned FSB regulation with tax, except for a few anti-avoidance areas. The biggest of which is investment contracts. There are a number of policies that are playing games with what's called insurance. And if you're a business, one thing you like about insurance is that when you pay premiums, you get a deduction. But if you invest in the bank account or you make a proper investment, you don't get a deduction for the investment. So what a very small group, they try to disguise an investment contract as insurance, but there's no risk transfer. Now, in accounting, they reclassify these things as investment contracts. And what we do in tax is we say that this is insurance and it's reclassified for accounting, we will reclassify it for tax. So it's a small group of players. But I think that's fairly straightforward. I think you'll also see this in the long-term insurance space as well. Then there is the last of the business tax things is the securities transfer tax. The securities transfer tax is a deceptively simple tax. And all it is if you buy a share, you have to pay a little fee, 0.25%, when you buy the share. So if you pay 100 for a share, you pay, what is it, 25 cents, what does that come out to? 25 cents, okay, my math isn't very good there. I need a Francis to save me. So 25 cents for 100 Rand share shouldn't be such a big deal. But unfortunately, the trading on the JSE is very complicated. And one issue that's come up, which we mentioned last year, is that oftentimes brokers hold shares in order to support derivative trading. And one of the problems is when the brokers are acquiring these shares, they really pass on the risks and rewards of the share to the other parties. And this has created a series of problems in the law, but there's a fairly large industry. And so what we did is we've adjusted the rules to allow brokers to act as market makers and derivatives, as well as banks, because banks in other jurisdictions also can be market makers. And so essentially, if you're market making in derivatives, whether you're a broker or a bank intermediary, we free you from the STT. The reason why is the margins in derivative trading is very small, and that 0.25% will eliminate all the profit margins. And that basically keeps up with the latest trends on the international markets. I think that's it for the business. Okay, some heavy stuff here. Heavy stuff. Big tax reform this year. Okay, international, I'm going to go through much quicker. On the international side, just to say about overall trends, the overall trend in the world is to steadily move away from pure worldwide taxation. And what's happening, you're finding, is lectures of 10, 15, 20 years ago was pushing for worldwide taxation called residence-based taxation, that if you're a resident, you're taxed on a worldwide basis. But what has happened over the years is you've had a choice. The old system we had pre-2000 was you're taxed on your South African income plus certain foreign source income. The other choice was to be taxed on a worldwide basis minus. What you have found over the last 10 to 15 years is that worldwide tax systems have increasingly had a bigger and bigger minus. So we've had to make more and more accommodation to keep our multinationals competitive. On the other hand, what we're trying to do is protect the domestic tax base. That's why the debt equity is very important. And so we're trying to protect our local source at the same time being more competitive internationally. And that's the balance that we're trying to strike. What we did, and this was last year's amendments, is clarifying, is that internationally, we have local reorganization rules, that allow you to have rollover treatment. What we've done in these rules is we've extended our local rules across the board so that now a multinational can reorganize its subsidiaries. And there's a whole series of amendments. There are some anomalies in that. We're working that out. I don't think that's a big issue, but I think we've moved forward quite a bit, and these rules will be welcomed by multinationals. Makes them much more flexible. But we are under a lot of pressure here because the UK has really softened its worldwide tax position, and that they are our major competitor. And that puts a lot of pressure on our system. Anyway, that's what all these slides are about. The other, and the one of the big ones is, if you remember Section 45, now that we've contained Section 45, we allow you to do it offshore. So that's slide 51. There is something else that's going on. It's called a participation exemption. And the participation exemption is what many countries have. They don't give rollover treatment for reorganizations, but they give total exemption. And what we have found is that this exemption puts the tax system at risk, in particular about corporate migrations, that there are some companies that are trying to use these rules as a corporate migration tool. And so while we've extended rollover treatment for company reorgs, we pulled back on this. And the only reason why we had this rule in the first place was we didn't have company reorg rules. So now that we have them, we've narrowed them. The question is, have we narrowed too much, and the taxpayers will say, well, we've taken too much away on this side and not put much on the other side. So we've just got to get the right balance, and I think that's just being worked out. Then there's the trade hold decision, which is when a company ceases to be a resident, they should have a tax charge. And the reason why is this is our last chance to tax them before they leave. So here you are, a South African company, you've grown locally, and now you want to leave. What we say is, well, before you leave, we want the gain, the tax on the gain, before you leave. There was a very unfortunate case called Trade Hold, which we lost in court. And the decision, I must say, is not one that I'm in love with. So I'll say that with judicial respect, right? But having said that, what we've done under 9H is we are reaffirming our charge that when you leave, you should pay all the gains that you accrued beforehand. So we are trying to restore this, and we've readjusted the charge so it's even more closely aligned with international principles. I think it always was, but now we're making it more closely aligned. That's essentially what we're doing. Withholding taxes. We are now having, if we pay interest to foreign residents, we are now enacting withholding taxes for the first time. This was proposed about a year or two ago. It's going into effect 2013. We are making our final adjustments. In addition, we are also adding cross-border royalty withholding, so that whenever you pay royalty and interest abroad, there should be a withholding charge subject to treaties. Now, we have a lot of treaties that override this. So this proposal is both basically creating a monitoring system that at least we know where all the flows are going, because right now we don't have a close monitoring system. And also, if you flow directly with tax havens where we don't have a tax treaty, then the withholding will apply. So that's what's happening here, and we're basically cleaning up the regime. There has been some request that this be delayed slightly to make sure that the administration and compliance systems are all available. The taxpayers may need more, a little more time, but that's coming into effect. We just move on, I think. Then there's a number of other amendments we're trying to do with business, and that is there's a number of anomalies when you're operating in Africa. And we have a number of tests which work theoretically, but in the African paradigm, they start causing problems. And one of them is worldwide tax applies if you have local effective management. But in many African countries, you find the infrastructure is weak. And so, and you might even find this in other developing countries as well. And what happens is the operations are going on in the foreign country, but a number of the management decisions are still held back in South Africa for speed. And then by keeping the management back, you enter into worldwide taxation. Because in order to be subject to worldwide tax, you either have to be incorporated in South Africa or effectively managed in South Africa. So companies are trying to do something commercial. Now, the CFC regime lets them out. We have something called the business establishment, that if you're doing legitimate foreign business operations abroad, we don't want to tax you on a worldwide basis. But then the common law is getting in trouble. And so what happens is taxpayers have to do dual returns, and you find that a lot of these countries are not tax havens. They have a tax rate similar to ours, and what they end up doing is filing two returns, but they end up not paying any greater tax to South Africa. Because the way it works is you're taxed in the other country first, and we only tax you where our rate is above their rate. So it creates a whole series of administrative complexities. And what we did is we said, we're removing you from this test where there's no real tax at stake. Similarly, on transfer pricing, many countries, many companies loan to African subsidiaries, and they do them zero interest loans. And the reason why they do that is they're often really basically share capital contributions in the skies. And what happens is then we start picking up an additional tax even though they're being taxed on the other side. And that's right from a transfer pricing point of view, but a lot of this debt is really equity. So this is a case where the taxpayers are calling something debt, but it's really shares, and we're looking to help the taxpayer. So it's a substance over form. So if we believe in substance over form, it should go both ways. Then there's our HQ regime. We picked up a few more anomalies. We're trying to clean that up to make sure it's even more business friendly. What we're doing there. Then the newest one is investment fund managers. For those in Cape Town, there are a number of people who like to live in Cape Town, and they like to manage foreign funds. And so many of these funds are located in the Cayman Islands, they're located in the Netherlands and Antilles, and elsewhere. That's where the bulk of these funds are. And sometimes they want to employ a South African manager. But because of common law notions, this fund is basically mostly funded with foreign investment, 95 or even 100%. So it's UK money, US money. But if a South African manager manages the fund, the common law deems the entity to be a South African entity, and we tax them on a worldwide basis. Even though all of the growth of the fund and everything belongs to the foreign resident, and all the manager is doing is managing. So we've created a foreign fund exemption. The UK has one as well. We've created a simplified one. We've entered into discussions with the industry. They want a few more changes, which I think could be accommodated. And basically, we want to allow people to manage the funds from here. Because what's happening is these local managers, because of the tax, are actually migrating abroad. And we don't want that to happen. So that's the loss of employment. So this has been long in coming. Then the last is a series of currency rules. Currency taxation is extremely complicated. Basically, what we've done there is we've moved the currency rules to match the accounting wherever possible. Just again, where it just gets too complicated and you follow the accounting and it's straightforward. And what we're doing here is on intragroup loans in particular. But there are a number of them. That the more we can match it, the more it simplifies compliance and administration. And taxpayers are indifferent because currencies can go up and down. So if it can match IFRS, wherever possible, it's preferred. And now you get a break from my voice. Yeah.
Thank you. I'll try and keep this short and simple because it mostly is short and simple. There are quite a few changes you'll see in the Tax Administration Amendment Bill, which are really just consequential changes and corrections following all the changes that were made by the committee last year. When it came before the committee, you'll remember there were quite a significant number of amendments. Sometimes we didn't think all the consequences of that through, and so there are a few things that we now need to do to align all the changes so that they work as we anticipated. And then there's some other clarifications and cleanups that need to happen as well. So if you work your way through that, the bill, you will see there are a number of those. The next slide, please. All right, so I'll just go through some of the highlights in the bill. The one you will recall from earlier in the year, this is the one-stop border post, and that is currently Lebombo Rosana Garcia is the one that we're looking at to start with. The agreement has been reached, I believe, by the committee in principle that it's good to sign the annexures for that agreement, which then will allow us to bring it into force. And what we then need is a piece of legislation to underpin the annexures once they have gone through the constitutional process. Okay, at the moment, the annexures are awaiting signature. Once that's happened, it'll obviously have to come back to the committee for approval, and we'll go through the constitutional process, and we can then bring it into force. Dividend withholding tax notifications. Dividend withholding tax has come into force. What happens here is you get certain concessions if you have a particular status. So perhaps you're a non-resident in a treaty country that has a reduced rate of withholding tax with South Africa. Perhaps you are an exempt entity. And at the moment, what's supposed to happen is the beneficial owner is supposed to let us know if that status changes, as far as ownership is concerned. But there are other things that could happen. Maybe you move from one country that has a DTA with South Africa to another country that doesn't. You should notify us of that too, so that we know to update that you don't get the reduced rate anymore. And that's what this is simply seeking to achieve. Dividend withholding tax refunds. At the moment, we make provision for refunds if the withholding tax is over-deducted because you didn't give us one of those notices about where you stayed or you had a particular status. Now, another reason you might need a refund is because foreign tax has been deducted. Okay, that wasn't a possibility that was considered, but logically, if there is foreign tax that has been deducted and South Africa needs to give you a foreign tax credit for that, that should be taken into account, and that's what this particular change does. Provisional tax estimates. Keith's already touched on this. The whole concept of lump sum withdrawals that you get from a pension fund or some sort of retirement fund, they go into a special tax table, right? So they're not part of the normal tax system. But the provisional tax system didn't keep up to date with that. So theoretically, you're supposed to take those into account when you do your provisional tax estimates. No, let's simplify the system, let's take them out because they are on a separate table and generally speaking, tax is withheld when that payment is made to you. So it doesn't need to come into your provisional tax system. If there is any shortfall or refund, we can deal with that on assessment. Provisional tax penalties. At the moment, if you get your provisional tax estimate wrong and you are a large taxpayer, SARS has a discretion whether to charge you the penalty or not. But if you're a small taxpayer, SARS must charge you the penalty and then has a discretion to decide whether to waive it. Okay. First proposal is, well, let's put everyone on the same footing. We'll switch it to SARS imposes the penalty, and then if you've got a good reason for why it shouldn't have been imposed, you tell us and we waive it. The other one is, and this has come up in before this committee last year, it's a practical issue. Sometimes your estimate may be wrong, but the amount of tax you have paid is right, okay, because tax was deducted through the employee's tax system and you've made a provisional tax payment. So although your estimate is wrong, we've got the right amount of tax. Now, theoretically, again, we should charge you a penalty, and then you'll explain to us that, no, you didn't need to avoid provisional tax because, as we can see, you have paid the full amount, even though the estimate was wrong. Okay, why put everyone through that? Let's just not charge the penalty in the first place. That's what this proposal is seeking to achieve. And then probably the one that you may hear a little bit more about is the regulation of tax practitioners. You'll all recall the minister had some words about personal non-compliance in the tax practitioner community, and that happens both within some of the professional associations members and then with the tax practitioners who are not members of any associations. So that, again, put the spotlight on regulation of tax practitioners. If their personal affairs aren't of the best, then how are they assisting their taxpayers as clients? Perhaps they're not giving them the best of advice, and perhaps those taxpayers need some redress if they do get bad advice. So the proposal that's been put on the table is a two-stage one. The first stage is essentially to say everybody needs to be a member of a professional association. And I suspect the professional associations will think that's a great idea. Phase two, then, is the one that we've been discussing for quite a considerable period of time, and that is that we have a statutory board along the line that auditors do. You have the independent regulatory board for auditors. Well, maybe we need an independent regulatory board for tax practitioners. And that is the phase two that is mentioned. Just to give a sense of how this would work, a tax practitioner would have to be registered either with an existing statutory body, so IRBA would be a good example that would regulate them, or they would have to be registered with a recognized tax practitioners association. Now, the question here is, well, you can't let any tax practitioners association spring up because you may get one that is devoted to the needs of all the crooks out there. So you need some kind of mechanism to identify associations that are relevant and that are in fact doing their job. And so SARS would recognize a tax practitioners association based on the fact that it's got a relevant and effective qualification requirement, an experience requirement, there's continuing professional education, there's a code of ethics and of conduct, and that they then actually discipline people who contravene the codes. Okay, the next one may seem a little odd, but essentially you should be not a profitable organization, you should be not for profit, you're doing it to promote the common interest of members. And then the last one is there's a minimum membership. Why? Because essentially for someone to do this job properly, they probably need a reasonable number of members to be sustainable. You can't have 50 people doing this, you need a reasonable bulk of membership. Right, just go back up again, please. Obviously, once they have been recognized, they may stop doing the good things that they should. So what happens then? Well, we need to give them notice that we have a problem, and then they need an opportunity to fix the problem if there is one. And then two last things that happen. The Act makes provision for the minister to appoint a panel of retired judges or people of similar stature to handle disciplinary matters for an association. This could be in two cases. Perhaps the association doesn't have the capacity and needs assistance, or perhaps the association is not too keen on disciplining its members, and so you need someone to step in and do it for them. And then finally, just to close the loop, you've got someone who can discipline members if they do things that are a little questionable. How do we report them? And so the range of misbehavior or misconduct that can be reported is extended to cover more tax-specific issues. And that's then the phase one package, which is in the bill currently. Phase two is something that we'd be looking at in a year and a half or so, after we've looked at how phase one has gone.
Got more taxpayer workshops. The next 2 days are filled with taxpayer workshops. Osmond, you're being there at both of them, is correct? Pete's only one. He's ratted out of one of them. But that will be heavily attended. We're going to have a series of meetings with taxpayers. We will be doing some extensive redrafting, as always. Then you will get to hear...
I hope they taxpayers or
they mix of both, unfortunately. Okay, there's some evil guys like in the back, but there are some good people, right? But yes, they're a mix of both. And then on the hearings, we will be hearing from them. We'll see what they say on the 22nd. There'll be some further changes to the bill. Please note we have to go to the state law advisors and the parliamentary law officers. And then on the 4th, you will get our response document, which will be nice and meaty. And we will tell you what we've accepted and not. And then you will tell us what you think, and we will make our adjustments. And then 11th of September will be the date of formal introduction. That is very tight for us, I must say. It would be nice if we had a little bit more time. I'm looking at Cindy. But I'm not sure whether we can square it. I'm doubtful, as a matter of fact. But the problem is we can't delay ministry introduction too long. Otherwise, we're going to miss this year entirely, because this year is a very shortened year. On the other hand, we do need a little bit of time. So that's all we are. But I think those are the dates to keep in mind in the near term.
The tightness is on the 11th of September that we might need to look at, yeah.
Oh, thank you very much. Baya danki. you know, you raise a very interesting metaphorical expression of a tree and fruit. And I know from where I'm sitting that those who are not in favor of that expression argues that it's not good for encouraging investment, because as a result, I mean, the number of people who might be intending to buy shares might decline, you know, because people fear that this is not going to, the shares are not going to yield as expected. But of course, we leave, I mean, the testing of the similarity of that analogy to this process that has been outlined. It will be interesting to get submissions from other stakeholders on the matter. Members, you know, I'm one of those who believe that a program is a scientifically determined outline of schedules or maybe activity that must be followed. So that simply says for people to draft a program, there is a lot of science that was involved, you know. So according to the program, we're supposed to be having a short break, have a tea break, and then from there, please, I think this team has helped you to obviously make sense of these technical corrections that are proposed. So as when we come back, we are able then to pose clarity-seeking questions and the relevant point for discussion. As we do that, let's not forget that this is not the last chance that we are having a bite on this. This is just an introduction of the bill. But it's important for us to clear areas that we think must be cleared. So as we go back, we are able then to have a clear comprehension of what goes into this bill. So for now, let's have a 10-minute tea break, and I'll expect members to be back at least at 11:20. Thank you very much.